to actually use them to constrain specific physical systems that you can understand as just lattice systems, or statistical systems, which are motivated from quantum gravity. And most of the, so I'm a bit wrong here because the computations have been done not here but at the AEI back in Potsdam, where they have a running cluster by putting it into the basement. Can, however, not use my. To see how actually move forward with these things. So the motivation is actually so we in quantum gravity we have spinform models which are the candidate theories for quantum gravity, and they describe, you know, very small scale physics. And the most important question typically in quantum gravity approaches is, okay, you come up with some model for your small scale physics. Does it actually describe anything which looks like gravity or smooth space on large scales? So the main problem is to extract large scale physics. And basically, we know one method to do that is to try to constrain your system and extract some effective physical description. And really know, for instance, what are the phases of your system. And the problem with spin forms is that they are amazingly complicated, so they have very complicated amplitudes. And so far, basically, computations which would involve something like many bodies or many nodes are more or less impossible. So there's not much information available. And the approach we are taking here is to simplify drastically these models. And so there are two simplifications which we do. One is a kind of dimensional simplification, and that's why we call these systems, one version of these systems, spin nets. And the other is to replace groups which we use. So in spin forms, you use rotational Lie groups, like SU2, which in terms of tensor networks means that, for instance, your index range would be always infinity, and we replace these by basically finite groups. So the interest for quantum information and condensed matter would be that these models are related to topological phases, strain nets, and basically work by symmetry breaking. And we basically use the same techniques for cross-training. Really weird. So, okay. I think now I'm. Stop. So, but like the trick we use is to basically define a spin form construction principle and to apply it to some more, to simpler models. And the aim is to develop techniques to basically test these techniques and hopefully to plow. Apply at some point at more complicated models. So the idea of the spin form construction principle is actually you start with a simple model, and basically you start, and for spin forms you start with topological field theories, and if you take actually Young-Mills lattice theory, go to zero coupling, you actually get something which is called BF theory and which is topological. And in a sense, statistically, it's a completely frozen model. So you rewrite this model into different variables. Basically, it's a duality transformation. And usually in these models, it looks a bit more complicated. So it looks more interesting. But it's still actually simple or topological. Or in other words, it would have, for instance, no renormalization flow because it's at a fixed point. So the next thing is, so you have these models as a partition function. So you sum over a certain set of configurations. And to get something more interesting, you actually forbid certain configurations in this partition function of your model. And in the first, so in this dual formulation, you actually have some gauge symmetries, which makes this model topological and simple. And by forbidding these configurations, you actually break these gauge symmetries. And in this way, you actually get non-topological models. BF is it's a theory which is called BF, unfortunately. B it doesn't stand for any names. So
is this a four, this is a four dimension?
BF, you can define it in any dimension, but you would start for gravity, you would start in four dimensions.
So did people try to do this whole thing? So in three dimensions, there's a very well-defined topological theory, which is just the term Simons.
Yeah, so BF, very simple, you can see it as a square of Chern Simons.
The what?
It's a square of Chern Simons.
But if you try to do this whole exercise just with Chern Simons? Since we know many analytical things about Chern Simons.
Yeah, so typically in spin forms, so basically the spin form models in 3D are topological. So they are BF because gravity in 3D is a topological theory. So typically you start at 4D and then you start with BF. And in 3D, the BF partition function is the square of the Chern Simons partition function. Okay? I'm not aware that anybody tried this exercise with Chern Simons, but you could, I guess. And if you take a very simple example of this method, you start with, say, you know, the generalized Ising model. So you have group variables. It's just generalized that instead of Z2, we take Z4, or later Zq. And so you have group variables on the vertices. You have a so-called edge weight. And you take, this is evaluated on this product of these group variables. So actually you get with that Q you get so-called generalized Potts models. So this is a well-known system. Now you freeze it, and freeze means basically in principle you go to zero temperature, and then this weight is a delta function. So basically all configurations or all group elements at the vertices have to agree, because on every edge, you know, the two group elements have to agree. So you would say, this is pretty boring, because it's just the partition function would be just equal to the number of group elements in your group. So now do a duality transformation, and you do that by just making basically transform these variables with the usual Fourier transform. Then it looks a bit more interesting, because you get now a partition function where you sum again with the same number of variables, but these basically labels here, which are group representations, sit now on the edges and not on the vertices anymore. But there's this slightly more complicated factor here, which is the delta function of the oriented sum of all the incoming indices and outgoing indices. So this is plus minus according to ingoing and outgoing. And this implements a very obvious thing, namely the Gauss law. So basically all the indices, the number of indices, the sum of indices of incoming indices has to be equal to the sum of the outgoing indices. So this looks slightly more complicated, and you could say it's still simple, but actually if you do this exercise really for non-abelian groups, you get here something which are just three coupling coefficients, and you would get like complicated looking amplitudes, but they would still be topological. So then it's not obvious anymore that we actually have a simple model. Okay, so this looks a bit more complicated, and actually you can check that there are gauge symmetries, but I'm not probably going to explain that. So to make this model non-topological, you just forbid some configurations. Say you don't sum over two. And then you get actually something which basically would change under cross-scaling, and it's a non-trivial model. So basically, what you actually do is you introduce a kind of temperature into this model by forbidding some configurations. And the space of models we will consider here are basically of the same type. This is the simplest kind of model you can come up with. So we have as variables Q, which is the size of your abelian group. And we define also K, kind of cutoff, which is basically the number of variables you sum over here. So here K would be 1 if you just define forbid 2. So this is actually the basic idea for constructing spinform models and starting with the topological field theory. So this would be not really the series you would start with, or spinforms, you start with lattice gauge theories. But there are many similarities between these kind of lattice gauge theories and these more simple lattice theories, which are based on edges or on edge weights. And so you could say, basically, we are just looking at edge models here. The problem with these models with abelian groups are still quite simple because you can rewrite them into, again, just the normal kind of POTS models. But for non-abelian groups, if you do these exercises, you actually get to vertex models. So you have weights on vertices, and these are much more complicated than these generalized POTS models. Okay.
The spatial index.
Sorry?
By fixing this index, do you break, I mean, something like a discrete analog of Lorentz symmetry?
What's the
price?
So by forbidding, by not summing over this index, so here, actually, in this, so the analog in BF theory, you break so-called translation symmetry, which in 3D gravity corresponds to diffeomorphisms, which you don't see. But in this, no, this is in 3D. Yeah, I mean, in 4D by discretization, you always break the diffeomorphism symmetry. And indeed, the question is whether you regain symmetries. So here, the symmetry you break is you can figure out for yourself that if you have actually a gauge symmetry, which is labeled by parameters on each of these plaquettes. And if you add, say, +1 to each of these edges in an oriented sense, you don't change the fact whether a configuration satisfies the Gauss laws or not. So this is a gauge symmetry. It's called like you translate all the indices by +1 or -1 or +2, whatever you group it. And this is broken if you forbid some configurations. So we want to coarse-grain this. And actually, for these kind of systems, there's a standard method which basically works with these edge models. The problem is this would not work anymore for the vertex models if you really go to non-abelian groups. But I just want to mention that because we are going to compare the tensor network methods with this model. And I will tell you what kind of physics to expect. So the idea in this coarse graining is that you start with the basic, with your basic partition function, so with your very fine-grained lattice, and you try to go to a more coarse-grained lattice by summing over some subset of variables. So in this case, you sum actually over all these variables, which sit here. And then you try to rewrite that into a similar form as your original partition function. And in this case, for Mikhail Kardanov, you try to rewrite it in the same form, but what changes is the edge weight. And Mikhail Kardanov basically is a very ingenious method which keeps you to local couplings. So it's basically an approximation where you actually approximate by just keeping local couplings in your partition function. And that leads to very simple recursion relations on the weights, which you are very easy to compute. compared to what we will do later. And the question which we are going to ask here, given some model, you can imagine it has basically some parameter here. It will basically either flow to the zero temperature, and zero temperature in some sense is basically this the phase where the gauge symmetries, these translation gauge symmetries are restored, or it will flow to infinite temperature. And this indeed happens on which models you are looking. So Mikhail-Kardanov can be easily applied in any dimension because it's just, again, a recursion relation on the edge weights, and you can check that easily. And for the 3D lattice gauge case, if you do that and basically plot the size of the group, this is this cutoff, so K, capital K. So if capital K is basically one half of Q, you are basically at zero temperature. So this defines you already the frozen model. If you sum over all variables, this is the high temperature regime. So you are red. And then if you start in the middle somewhere, you know, then there's a question where you flow to. And in this case, for this configuration, you would flow to the high temperature regime. And there are basically only very few models, examples, where you flow back to the low temperature regime and would restore your symmetry. So basically, mostly you flow to low temperature. And more or less, there's a mathematical proof if you even increase the groups to U1 and SUN, for instance, you are just left with the high temperature phase. So all configurations flow to high temperature, which in lattice gauge theory would be basically the confining phase. And the reason is that 3D is actually too near to 2D, and 2D is basically the critical dimension of for lattice gauge theories, which means that in 2D you don't have any phase transition. And with this method in 3D, you also don't really have a phase transition because everything just flows to one phase. 4D, which is, so the, I didn't explain that, but actually there's lots of similarities between 4D lattice gauge systems and 2D, just 2D kind of Ising systems. So that's why it's also interesting to look actually at these 2D models, because it might tell us something about the 4D case. And 4D is, of course, a bit more away from 3D than 2D than 3D. And indeed, the things look a bit more interesting and unfortunately also numerically very challenging. So not with the Mikhail-Kardanov, but what happens is that there's a phase transition. So you see, you know, that you have high temperature, much less things flowing to high temperature, more things flowing to low temperature. And we have these funny green things here, and these funny green things are things which don't really converge for a very long time, and they're basically quasi-fixed points. And I have to fasten up. And the problem will be that these define very weak phase transitions, which in any numerical, if you simulate, will be basically very hard to handle. Okay, so basically the physical problem or the problem for the tensor network scheme is also that basically we have these very weak phase transitions. So in the last minutes, just let me tell you what we did there, because that was actually most of the work. So the tensor network, the idea behind using tensor networks here is that you write your partition function as a contraction over lots of tensors which are associated to the vertices. So basically now the variables are given by the indices. So basically the indices are the fields, and the weights are encoded in these tensors, and you can basically rewrite lots of statistical physics systems in this way. And you contract, of course, this along the edges. So if you want to coarse grain, it means that you go from this square, you contract it to some effective tensor. As you can see already, this effective tensor has two indices, and you can make it to a one effective index, but it would multiply the index range. So So you, the trick is to find some approximation to cut down the index range again, index range against again. And yeah, so you have to implement this cutoff. Implicitly, you actually allow in this method for non-local couplings because you introduce much more variables if you make this index range large. And the idea is basically in each step here, you apply a field redefinition so that this tensor is more or less has only components on the basically relevant fields. So basically, we more or less use a renormalization algorithm from Wen and Gu for covalent lattice. And this, again, uses the same trick as Lukasz explained, more or less. You first try to go to matrices. And this is basically first you take your covalent vertices, expand them into two three-valent vertices. And at this stage, you actually implement your cutoff. I'm not going into much details. It works with a singular value decomposition. And at some point, you know, this gives you eigenvalues, which are all positive, or singular values, which by definition are all positive. And you cut off basically you throw away small singular values. So you decide, basically, I want to keep only the 10 largest singular values of the system, and that defines your index range. and then you contract again these three-valent vertices to something which is four-valent, and you get a coarse-grained lattice and a new effective tensor, and then you do that again and again and again. so compared to the literature, the problem we have is that we look at comparably large groups because we try to go to large queues. So we look at. So the things which are possible, you know, we went until 32, for instance. And then, you know, things get quite slow already. so we look at quite large groups. So up to 2 equal to 20, which didn't really have be looked at in the literature before, or we didn't found anything. And the problem is that with increasing size of the group, you get weaker and weaker phase transition. And you really see that. So you can actually, in the Mikl-Cardanov, you can go to 10,000 iterations, and nothing happens. And then 20,000 something happens. And if you have to go to 10,000 iterations, it's not really fun. Okay, so actually, more or less, we get more, the same results as with the Mikl-Cardanov. So there are some slight differences. So this is the same diagram encoding to which fixed points these models flow. And we have also these green things. The details are, however, a bit more complicated. I have to say that basically that no Mikl-Cardanov would, per model, just take like 5 minutes. Here, something takes can take like a day or 2 days on a cluster, and 5 minutes are on a laptop. So, bit different in effort. So let me close with a few remarks. So I didn't really tell you any details about the algorithm. So we have these Gauss constraints. It's very important, actually, that you do it intelligently and implement these Gauss constraints to hold at every step. Otherwise, you get a very unstable algorithm. there's a general problem, which is already described in the Gu-Wen paper and in the previous Levine paper, that basically what happens in this coarse grinding is not well physically understood. And actually, you get non-isolated fixed points, which says that, you know, your cutoff method is not really well understood, and we have actually maybe some relevant stuff still happening. And we didn't really address that. We didn't really care about these non-isolated fixed points. But basically, you run into also into these fixed points, but you can still classify them to be low temperature or high temperature. But for these higher, for these larger groups, the problem is that you get actually kind of instabilities, which we try to improve by basically improving this method and improving this brute force cutoff. Like, let me show the simplest example here. So one problem is that if you cut it off at the given index range, you actually break a certain symmetry, which is the symmetry between k and minus k. So you have one reflection symmetry, and if you just cut it off at a given range, you break the symmetry. Once the symmetry is breaking, the system is very unstable and just evolves like in an oscillating way. And what you see here is basically the values of these different singular values, which you compute in every step. And you see that, you know, basically this basically tells you that these are basically changing quite randomly. So this is the number of iterations. And so these are the singular values. So in every step, you go to, you decompose your tensor into a matrix. And you can compute the singular values for this matrix. And these are the values for the singular values for this matrix. And if you have this picture, it tells you that the thing is not converging at all because it's just widely fluctuating. and if you do the following, you basically adjust the cutoff. Your cutoff has to be bigger than a given number, but you choose the smallest number such that the symmetry is not broken, so it's basically this reflection symmetry, then this already improves a lot, as you can see. But nevertheless, that is basically always the question. So basically, it happens that the structure of the tensor networks and the singular values changes sometimes abruptly. I cannot really. So it's actually that you cut several things off, and sometimes the order of what might happen is that a singular value which corresponds to a negative eigenvalue grows and changes its place with a positive eigenvalue, and this would largely influence your system. So this might happen at some step, for instance, and this gives you these jumps, for instance. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, you can do different things, and so what is work in progress is really that we have a relation that you can just take the tensor network method and do a drastic thing, and you seem to get something like Mikhail-Kardanov. One has to basically understand these approximations in the tensor network method better, and this basically, for instance, understands the significance of these negative eigenvalues. So we have looked at very coarse-grained questions. What one could do is to try to detect the phase transition temperature in these abelian models. And basically, the really interesting thing is to go to non-abelian models where you really have vertex models. And for these, you cannot apply the Mikhail-Kardanov, or I wouldn't know how to do that. And the phases are largely unknown for these vertex models. Okay, let me stop here.
Are you trying essentially only one coarse graining method? Or, I mean, it's an arbitrary choice how you coarse grain, right?
Basically the Mikhail-Kardanov, that was one method, and the tensor network was the second method. And so these small, the improvements would change your method. So in a sense, defines a slightly different methods. But of course,
you can. If you use a different method, you get a very different result.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you hope not, but yeah.
So it's a related question. So you have a method, whatever that means. You input your system, and you get some fixed point. But do you have any idea what's happening in between? Do you have a way of, so there are truncations where you throw away parts of your system. Do you have any idea of how to control these approximations and what they mean?
So this is why we looked also at Mikhail-Kardanov, because for Mikhail-Kardanov it's much better understood what happens.
In the sense that?
So there's a proof by Kalinov that the free energy is bounded by below, if I remember that correctly, for the two system compared to the Mikhail-Kardanov system.
But you still flow to some fixed point.
You flow to some fixed point.
Maybe completely determined by the method, not by the original system.
But in principle, there's an advantage of the tensor network method, which is that you can enlarge your cutoff.
Right.
And so you would be very happy if you get one result which stabilizes by making this cutoff bigger.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that is not completely the case.
Okay.
But this is, I don't know, I think it's really difficult because you have these postulates, you have these very weak phase transitions appearing,
But do you have any example where by enlarging this one dimensional truncation, that you go to some result that does no longer depend on these truncations?
Yes, of course, for the simple examples where you have a strong phase transition, then these things don't change anymore. But we haven't really looked at very fine-grained fashion, so we haven't looked at the phase transition temperature, which would tell you better how these things change. I think we have for the easing model. So for the easing model, we computed how the phase transition temperature changes. But for the easing model, these things are very, very simple. So many things which happen for higher order models don't happen for easing models. If you go into the larger groups and go into this weak phase transition scheme, you just, you end up with these green areas which run for very, very long time, and which physically means actually that whatever you do, you throw away a large chunk. So the singular values which you throw away are typically the same size.
Okay, at that point you should not have the math.
And then, we tried some improvements, but this is really the problem with the weak phase transition. So far it's not really working for if you really go near the phase transition. Okay.